this event together, and particularly to Jack DeJoya, my friend, who I will have the pleasure of introducing later. Over the years, Georgetown has become something of a second home for me. I graduated from its law center in 1976, and I guess I didn't disappoint my professors too much because they actually invited me back to serve on the law faculty, where I currently serve as a visiting professor. You know, when I first came to Georgetown in the early 1970s, it was a very tumultuous time in our country. There was Vietnam, there was the civil rights and women's rights movement, there was Watergate. And today we find ourselves living in an equally tumultuous time. We witnessed September 11th and Hurricane Katrina. We're fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. North Korea is testing a nuclear weapon, and peace between the Palestinian people and Israel remains elusive. Moreover, we find ourselves facing new and ever-increasing threats from global warming, global terrorism, global poverty and disease. In my years, I've learned that in times of great turmoil, Americans have historically rallied together, drawn strength from their shared sense of pride, and looked to their leaders to help them confront challenges and forge ahead towards a better future. We saw this after September 11th when we put aside our differences and came together as one nation, with one spirit around one terrible event. We also saw this in the aftermath of Katrina when legions of volunteers rushed to aid the hurricane's victims in New Orleans, Biloxi, and Gulfport. When the worst happens, there is no doubt that the best instincts and actions come out in the American people. But if you talk to the volunteers who worked at Ground Zero or who helped hurricane victims in the Gulf, I think they themselves will tell you that the charitable work of ordinary citizens was meant to augment the important work of government, not to replace it. It is not the job of volunteers to build new levees or operate wastewater treatment plants or fly helicopters to rescue stranded families. Likewise, it's not the job of nurses or doctors to ensure that everybody can afford their care. And it's not the job of students to make sure that college tuition rates remain affordable. That's the job of government. And when we stand back and surmise the sum total of the challenges we face today, it's easy to see that they are the result of, in what my view, is a failed approach to government, a morally bankrupt philosophy which the wordsmiths of the radical right have dubbed the ownership society. They put forward a philosophy focused on individualism, in which people theoretically have more choices and assume more risk in nearly every part of their lives. In theory, the result of this approach is that people will save more, own more, rely less on government, and become greater stakeholders in the future of our country. It's a prescription calling for a heavy dose of conservatism with hardly a whiff of compassion. That's the theory, but let's look at the results. Consider that right now, as we gather here this morning, over 46 million of our fellow citizens do not have health insurance. Poverty rates are climbing and personal saving rates are plummeting. The richest 1% of households already owns more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. Oil companies are taking in record profits while global warming advances at a record pace. And college tuition rates continue to skyrocket and wages stagnate. Cutting through the rhetoric, the facts show that in this quote-unquote ownership society, most Americans have been left to fend for themselves. They're owners of more burdens and fewer opportunities. And when once they turned to their leaders to help them get ahead and stay afloat when times were bad, this is no longer the case. Because today, corruption, cronyism, and greed now extend from corporate America to the halls of Congress. But it doesn't have to be this way. And as progressives, I think it's our job to ensure that it does not stay this way. That's why the Center for American Progress is working hard to develop, articulate, and implement a progressive vision of the common good. At its core, a progressive vision of the common good stands in stark contrast to "you're on your own" mantra of the radical right. Under a progressive vision of the common good, government must pursue policies that benefit everyone equally. It must ensure that opportunities are abundant and that even those who have been left out and left behind can get the help they need to succeed. Common good progressivism does not mean that everybody will be the same, think the same, or get the same material benefits. Rather, it simply means that people should start from a level playing field and have a reasonable chance to improve their station in life. Internationally, common good progressivism focuses on new and revitalized global leadership through the just use of force, multilateral engagement, and the creation of new institutions and networks to deal with difficult problems. As in past battles against fascism and totalitarianism, Common good progressives today seek to fight global extremism by using a comprehensive national security strategy that employs all our strengths for strategic and moral advantage. To pursue the common good, though, we as Americans owe something to our country in return. People must assume responsibility for their actions, treat others with respect and decency, and serve their families and communities. Likewise, political leaders we want American businesses, to innovate, to succeed, and to create jobs and wealth. But we also believe in corporate responsibility. Business leaders should act ethically and take consideration their communities, workers, and surrounding environments when making decisions. Without question, the protection and promotion of the common good is a powerful theme running through many strands of our country's history. For instance, faith leaders from Father John Carroll, the founder of this great institution, to Martin Luther King Jr. have drawn on the principle of the common good to guide people towards more thoughtful consideration of their own action and values. Likewise, political leaders from James Madison to Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt have used principles of common good progressivism to shape their notions of government and craft some of our country's most important and lasting policies. They've done that through the actions of both parties. As Thomas Jefferson stated in his first inaugural address to the nations, Americans living within our constitutional framework, he said, should arrange themselves under the will of the law and unite in common efforts for the common good. In the more recent past, our featured speaker today, my friend and former boss, President Clinton, showed how common good approach to governance could lift people up, help those left behind, and speak to the collective desire to be part of something bigger than ourselves. 15 years ago, the then governor and candidate Clinton, with the help of Bruce Reed, who's with us today, and Al Fromm from the DLC, articulated a new vision for America and its role in the world. This new covenant, as he called it, was delivered right here in Gaston Hall through three historic speeches. Combined, his three addresses outlined a vision to invest in the common good by giving economic power back to the ordinary Americans, demanding responsibility of our citizens, recapturing a collective sense of community, and restoring America's greatness in the world. He stood here almost 15 years ago to this day and said, "I believe with all my heart that the only way we can hold this country together and move boldly into the future is to do it together with a new covenant, a solemn agreement between the people and their government to provide opportunity for everybody, inspire responsibility throughout our society, and restore a sense of community to our great nation. A new covenant to take government back from the powerful interests and the bureaucracy and give it back to the ordinary people of our country." During the 8 years he served as president, this new covenant was put to work, and as a result, our country experienced unparalleled economic prosperity, security of the homeland, a strong and efficient foreign policy, and a restored sense of community. Today, we're back in Gaston Hall to commemorate the president's speeches with our own conference on the common good. In addition to hearing a keynote address by President Clinton, we're also honored to be joined by Congressman Kendrick Meek, who I will introduce momentarily, along with a distinguished group of scholars, policy experts, elected officials, labor, and faith leaders. At today's conference, we'll explore the origins, ethical requirements, and policy implications of the common good, with the goal of bringing its values and policies into practice. And together, I honestly believe we can restore our nation's most sacred principles, revitalize our communities, and forge ahead towards a better future for all Americans. We can bring back the American dream and make it real again. So thank you again for joining us today as we embark on this endeavor. With that said, it's now my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, the Honorable Kendrick Meek. Congressman Meek took his first elected office at the young age of 27. We were just talking about that in the back. Less than a decade later, he succeeded his mother, Carrie P. Meek, who I had the pleasure of working with when I was Chief of Staff in the White House, in the United States House of Representatives, representing the 17th District of Florida. Today, Congressman Meek is actively and aggressively working to promote and protect some of the key underlying principles of common good progressivism, responsibility, opportunity, and community. For instance, as one of the youngest ranking members in Congress, he recently called for greater accountability in federal recovery aid for disaster zones after his subcommittee found fraud in the use of money allocated to New York City after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. He's working to improve public education. In 2002, he fought hard for a citizens' initiative to reduce class size in Florida's overcrowded public schools. Facing strong resistance from his own governor, Congressman Meeks saw the amendment through two battles in the state Supreme Court and eventually saw it approved by 2.5 million of Florida's citizens. He is also committed to fostering the growth of minority leaders and sponsoring the betterment of the African American community. In January, Congressman Meeks and the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation launched the Black Health Empowerment Project to educate African Americans about the chronic health conditions linked to obesity. He's also worked tirelessly to promote aid initiatives for the Haitian immigrants who arrive in Florida seeking a better life, fighting to keep these families together, to honor their cultural contributions to our communities, and to promote global equity through much-needed trade assistance to their native country. In a relatively short period of time, Congressman Meek has proven to be a steadfast, ardent advocate of the policies that support a progressive vision of the common good, and we're very pleased to have him lead off this conference here today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming